You look better though than you did a couple hours ago. Some of you were nodding and it's the afternoon and now you're a little bit, something in your stomach fresh, getting a little cooler. I'm going to kind of introduce this and then Alice is going to tell you about her pilgrimage and I'm going to tell you a little bit about my pilgrimage. So part of the work of the order is pilgrimage. So part of the praxis of being a monk is at times taking this kind of a journey that's intentional. If you think about this historically, an ordinary Christian in the Middle Ages could take a pilgrimage. And it was sort of the closest thing that the ordinary Christian could do that was like a monk might do, which was to leave regular life and go into the desert. Well, they couldn't do that, but they could take a pilgrimage. And you know, many of you have been on pilgrimages. The order a couple of years ago had a pilgrimage. Some of you were on that. Alice has just returned from a pilgrimage of a month, right? A month, and then mine was a week. So let me do a tiny bit of sort of theoretical work here, and then I'll set up Alice to tell us about her journey. A pilgrimage is a universal spiritual exercise of holy movement, which we as monks undertake for a multitude of reasons, and some of those reasons are not even known to us. We sort of like birds wanting to do this. Sometimes we know we want to do it, but we don't know exactly why. Richard Niebuhr said that pilgrims are persons in motion, passing through territories not their own, seeking something we might call completion or clarity, a goal to which only the spirit's compass points the way. So we journey to a place, a specific place, to meet someone perhaps, maybe a person, maybe it's just the place itself, but the poles of heaven and earth are thought to meet there, a thin place where the power seems to me when I was going to sites in Galilee that the power was not so much what had happened there historically, which could not have been proven, may or may not have happened there historically, but the fact that pilgrims had gone there over a long period of time and continue to go there, and there was, that's where the power is. A pilgrimage might be a year, a month, a week, a day, could be an hour. We could even think of the labyrinth out here. It's a mini pilgrimage. Some of you have done that over the weekend. A rosary is more of a symbolic pilgrimage, or making that path. Gene and Wallace Clift wrote a book called The Archetype of Pilgrimage. And they take Joseph Campbell's hero's journey and talk about three parts here: separation, liminal stage, and then return. And I've been thinking about this last few months in a more contemplative way and have thought about this as intention, attention, and then reflection. And so just briefly here as an introduction, you might think about those stages. And those of you that are going on pilgrimage in the next year or years ahead, with intention, we might think about desire, longing, impression, inclination, something sort of snaps, clicks, something happens. For me, with this pilgrimage I took to Israel, Garrett, whom many of you have met, he was here 2 years ago, came out for dinner. I think he was kind of hungry. he was hungry in many ways. And anyway, he graduated from Baylor last year. And so when my daughter graduated from Baylor, we gave her a trip with mom to Europe. So we were kind of thinking about that for Garrett. And I hadn't mentioned anything to him yet. But I had thought about the Camino for him and me, maybe together. But I kind of put it out of my mind because it just seemed too long. And neither one of us were going to have the time. But then one day he brought home a movie called The Way. And he didn't know what it was about. He said, "I heard this is a good movie, you know, watch it with me." Well, he never asked me to watch a movie with him. He's never done that. So I said, "Sure." So we watched it, and it was about a father-son kind of story about going on the Camino in Spain. So I said, "Okay, yeah, I've got to think about this." So, and it ends up we did a pilgrimage to Israel on the Jesus Trail, which I'll say a little bit more about in a minute. So intention: do we have a desire, longing, inclination? Something happens. Are we destined to do this? We sort of invite the universe to comment on our longing or our inclination. How does the universe comment on that? On our intention? Does the universe affirm it in some way? So to me, that's the intentionality part. Attention, so once you leave, you're on the way, the liminal stage, you're no longer in a sense yourself. I'm doing some writing on this, and I'd hope to have it finished for the weekend, but it's not. But I'll send it out. This liminal stage, you know, you're leaving your ordinary self. My son was more of my brother now, so it's a very interesting thing that happens. Four things about intention that I've thought about. One is attention to sensory detail, trying to notice colors and smells and that kind of things, and hear what you're hearing and being attuned to that, which is sometimes difficult in a foreign country. You sort of become numb easily. The second is non-judgmental attention. This was sort of a mantra for us. Go to the root of everything that happens. Judge nothing. Like a woman who knows many things, like a child who knows nothing. From the Talmud, isn't that good? Yeah. So non-judgmental attention. Victor Turner calls it the eye of innocence. The eye of innocence. Sometimes it's hard to do that, right? As an American traveling to another place, wanting a place to be like your place is often what we do. Third is attention to feeling. Niebuhr suggests that the perception the pilgrim seeks is more than clarity of eye, it's also clarity of heart. So watching one's responses, sort of backing away from one's responses and watching it, is valuable. Then fourth is non-egoic attention. Non-egoic attention of softening the ego's focus and allowing the unconscious to form, inform, even deform what's going on there. So in a practical sense, this kind of attention might be a dream you have on the journey, memories that occur on the journey, synchronicities, of course. They're always full of those. meditations that you intentionally have, and visions, and that kind of thing. And then finally, to return home, the pilgrim returns home as someone else. Right? And home is always different, and your journey as well. New vision. I'm still in the reflection about this. Part of my reflection will be saying a little bit to you and having that conversation. So with that short introduction then, so Alice is going to talk about her pilgrimage, which is on one of the most well-known trails in the world for a pilgrimage. She's told me a little bit about it, and I want to look forward to hearing more.
Well, y'all know, you know who I am, basically. Almost all of you know who I am. I've been Marie Warder for a few years now. And I'm still building on this, what it means to be a monk. And pilgrimage has presented itself a few times as something that's very important to mark out time in my life for. Blake's introduction was wonderful, and it actually helped me focus and figure out some things. That I really look forward to reading when you do finally put your reflection out, because you're an excellent teacher about this. And I think there does need to be a little bit of a tutoring on what pilgrimage is. The attention and intention. You know, when I come to these gatherings, this is a pilgrimage for me. I just realized that at the end of what you're saying. You know, I come, my intention is to come to the gathering here, and then while I'm here, I try to pay as much attention to every detail and all the relationships and everything that's going on, and soak in as much as I can, and then I return with these wonderful gifts that I give out to, you know, the richness I've gained here I give out to everyone around me. So this pilgrimage that I went on, the Way of St. James, the Camino de Santiago, has become quite a popular route. It fell out of popularity, so it's had its ups and downs. Does everybody know, basically, do I need to give the history of the Camino? Anybody not know the history of the Camino de Santiago? Anybody pretty much know?
Yeah, why don't you hit it quick.
I'll hit it quick. What it is this ancient path, it's a very solid infrastructure. It crosses from the Camino Frances goes all the way across the north of Spain from east to west, from the French border all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. It was the original, this is one of the earliest Caminos. There are many Caminos. There are roads for pilgrimage that all end up in Santiago. They originate in Portugal, in France, and in England. I mean, they're all over the place they start, and they wend their way. But the Camino Frances was the most popular one, always has been, has the most infrastructure on it. It was fortified greatly in the 12th century. The kingdoms of Aragon and Navarre, France and Spain, put lots of money into it and hired the Knights Templar to come and be security guards and help them, help pilgrims on the way. But basically they were building a road that was supposed to be a bulwark against the encroaching Moors. So the Moors were coming up from the south, and so they wanted to make a big statement with this. And what ended up being this road that where the pilgrims were, the front lines of Christendom were walked by the pilgrims. But this became is one of the first earliest cultural exchanges in Europe, where people from all parts of Europe could penetrate into Spain and be exposed to the riches of Spanish culture. Their cathedrals, their villages, their artistry. And of course, then there was a lot of cross-pollination throughout the Camino at that point, because artisans came in from, you know, at this point from Germany and England, and from all the other, from France, they all started cross-pollinating there. And to this day, many, many pilgrims do this as a cultural pilgrimage. There's a lot of types of pilgrimages, and the religious one seems to be only one in our modern times, a sliver of that. The Camino was very popular during the 9th and 12th to 12th centuries, and it was walked by St. Francis of Assisi, it was walked by Isabel and Ferdinand, it was walked by kings, queens, commoners, everybody side by side. And so it has had thousands and thousands of souls walking, and they all leave their impressions behind. Every single one. There's an incredible sense of solidarity amongst pilgrims that you're walking this way together, much like we do in life. After the 12th century, the popularity of the Camino declined rapidly, especially between the 17th and 20th centuries. The Nadir was around 1980, apparently. There was only about 200 pilgrims a year passing along the way to Santiago. But there's been a booming renewal of interest due to the efforts of some priests that lived along the Camino. I'm not going to go into that story, but the number of pilgrims has increased this last year, 2012, on this same Camino. This one Camino, and I'm only talking about this one Camino, Frances, there are about 200,000 pilgrims have passed through this year. And out of those, Americans are becoming a larger and larger slice of the demographic pie due to probably largely the impact of the movie The Way. And the movie The Way is what influenced my husband and I, Stuart and I, to embark on the Camino. We saw it and immediately were impressed with an immediate desire. And it was so clear that I understood that that was our call. And I really think that movie has called so many people that I really think the Holy Spirit's working through that movie, inspiring Americans, because Americans don't have anything like this in this country. You know, Europeans, they pick up a backpack from the time they're teenagers and go backpacking across Europe, right? But we don't have that kind of opportunity, and I think it really appeals, has great appeal, with good reason, because Americans really need a pilgrimage route. They need something. We're not talking the Appalachian Trail. We're not talking, you know, rugged, carrying your tent and all this stuff. Not the same thing. Because you're traveling through villages, towns, and it's very social. And you're only carrying a backpack with your clothes and a sleeping bag, you know, and so you're doing a bunch of day hikes. And a lot of it is spent around tables talking with people who don't speak your language. Pantomiming, you know, and getting along with all sorts of people. So anyway, the call is really important, and I think that you know it when you get called to go on pilgrimage. I've been called a few times, and I've become very sensitive to it. And it is an intention that gets set up in your heart. And I believe that if you make the commitment to the call, if you respond to the call and say, here I am, I'm ready to do this, then, as Blake pointed out, the universe lines up everything. And, well, I mean, he said, you know, you're inviting the universe to either put a check mark in that column or not. And I found that it did put, it lined, everything lined up in synchronicity for us to go. We're not people of a great amount of means, but we managed to save up the money to do this Camino within 6 months. We just immediately, it was incredible how quickly things manifested for us. My husband was astonished, and he's never been anywhere out of the country, out of an English-speaking country. So when we got to the Camino, we did a 40-day journey, and so it was more than a month. And so it was 40 days, and there's something about the biblical number of 40. I think there's reasons that you spend 40 days in the wilderness. And I think this is because the cycle of a 30-day cycle, we're so accustomed to that. We're so accustomed to a 30-day cycle. Anybody can deal with 30 days, you know. You can count down from 30 days. It's a moon cycle. But 40 is a different matter. Because you've been out there in a strange liminal space for 9 days, and you're going, I still have 32 days to, oh my God. And so psychologically, I think the 40-day thing is interesting because it breaks up patterns. It breaks even your patterns of habitually thinking about time. So I was, you know, reflecting on what that was about. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon. So anyway, we were called, we committed, we went. And I really felt the support of St. James, or the universe, however you want to put it, from the very first day we committed to the very moment we stepped back on our threshold back home at midnight of the 40th day, walking with our backpacks back into our house. Now, the motives of these pilgrims, and you know, motives are an interesting thing because you might start out with one motive, as Blake pointed out. You might not really know why you want to do this. People have their reasons, and they get asked their reasons, and they have to write down. And when you're in the pilgrim's office to get your passport, you get a pilgrim's passport, which allows you to travel through the Camino and get special treatment as with a pilgrim status, meaning cheap accommodation in the refugios, the hospices, and cheap meals, and you know, that sort of thing. But they ask you the reason why you're traveling the Camino. They ask it at the beginning, and they ask it at the end. It's very interesting. And most people, they take the statistics of religious, spiritual, change of life, you know, sport. And you'd be surprised how many people do it for sport. And Stuart and I were kind of surprised at how very secular it was, actually. You had to actually kind of seek out, the churches were mostly locked. When you tried to get in them, they were mostly locked. There were pilgrim masses here and there where they were sort of desultory. Nothing seemed very... There wasn't a lot of vibration around the religious path so much. It was people with their trekking poles, and they were kind of racing to the next place. But I spoke with I was at a table with a bunch of French people one night, and I'm trying to struggle with understanding the French. And I understood this woman. I said, you know, I asked her. I said, it seems like so many pilgrims are doing this with the motif sportif. You know, they just want to. They want to be through here for sport. And she got a real twinkle in her eye, and she just said to me, ah, you know, they may start out doing the Camino for sport, but the Camino has its way of working on them and has a way of working on everybody. It does. It takes you into that liminal space. And so people, there is a sense of faith that you have to throw yourself into this, which brings me to the difference between a pilgrim and a tourist. It's very important because some people on the Camino were approaching it like a tourist, but it's their Camino, and you become non-judgmental, and the mantra is, that's their Camino. You know, it doesn't matter. Everyone has their own Camino. Somebody's Camino, they might have gotten a big, huge blister the first 5 days, and then they go home. That's their Camino. But people who come as a tourist, you know, I think they probably are transformed into pilgrims at some point on the way. But tourists and pilgrims are different. Tourists go to a place and they have expectations that things will be like they are at home, or they want to have the comforts of home. They have expectations, and they have needs, and they have requirements. And they expect a certain level of, you know, treatment or lifestyle. Whereas pilgrims are grateful. They are just grateful for everything that comes along, whether it's good or bad, anything that happens. And pilgrims are also flexible and ready to deal with any sort of spontaneous situation that comes along. So you don't have your accommodations planned ahead. You are depending on the kindness of others. You're throwing yourself at the mercy of others around you on the pilgrimage. That's part of embedding yourself in the experience completely and immersing in it, I think. There are, and I met a couple of mendicants, you know, those who carry no money. And they go on the Camino with not a cent, and they walk the way, and that's very brave. I think that's really tough, but there are people that do that. There were a lot of heroic people that were doing this for an assortment of reasons. Some of them were obviously had physical infirmities. I've heard of people doing this with serious diseases. Some people do it at the end of their life. A lot of people die on the Camino. There are a lot of memorials to dead pilgrims, and some people chose to do that. That's exactly what they wanted to do. That's the last thing they wanted to be doing was pilgrimage. And there was a Japanese couple, I was telling somebody here, that there was a Japanese couple that checked into the pilgrim office, I heard. And they were very proud to get their Compostelas, but they wanted them written into the name of this somebody else. And they both had this Compostela dedicated to somebody else. And the officer at the office said, excuse me, but do you mind my asking you, how many times have you done this pilgrimage, and what for? And they said, this is our 10th pilgrimage.
Wow.
We've done this 10 years in a row. And we do this in the memory of our daughter who died at age 10. And now we have done the 10th year and we are finished. We're done. We're not going to do this again. So that's a really, there are poignant stories like that all the time. We heard people's stories. You know, getting to know people's backstory was really a big part of the Camino. The first night we were there, we had to sort of had a squirmy moment in our first lodging where we were all at a communal table, 18 of us, and we all had to stand up and say why we were doing the Camino. And it was very squirmy. People, you know, it was kind of like, people didn't necessarily want to give their reasons. But this Irish woman said to us that night, she said, just remember this, everybody on the Camino is carrying some pain and they all have a backstory, as we all do. We all have some sort of trauma of some sort in our lives, and often a pilgrimage calls us to come and heal that or solve that or at least move along on the path of healing. And so she said, so be very delicate and careful with people and mindful. They all have a backstory. And I kept her advice in mind. And I'll just tell you about one particular pilgrim who I met named Irene. She was from Australia. And when I met Irene, I just had this, she gave off a real feeling of profound sadness. And but she wasn't willing to talk about it. You can talk to pilgrims endlessly about their blisters and their tendonitis and all that stuff. But they won't talk about the things that really brought them there. So we were loping along together here and there. I found myself walking side by side with her, lodging with her, having dinner with her and another pilgrim several times. These become your Camino family, these people that you have a loose affiliation with. You're all walking west to Santiago. You're gonna keep meeting up with them. Finally, you know, one time we went to a small church, and it was a little Templar church, a little eight-sided Templar church with a beautiful acoustic, and I went in and started singing Songs of the Presence and various chants. And when Irene was invited to come in there with me, as was Stuart, and I sang, the one chant that I was singing in all of the churches that I got into was Dona Nobis Pacha. I mean, if you were to sing canon round. I figured that was pretty universal and that everybody might know it. It's Latin, it's short, it's sweet. And so I was singing that, and Irene was in a faltering voice singing along with me, you know, trying to sing along, and pretty soon she fell away and went outside. And then while I was in there singing, another pilgrim walked in, and I didn't look at her, but she was at the back of the church and I was at the front just singing away. And then I paused, and I could feel her presence back behind me. And she started singing a beautiful hymn in Latin. She just started singing a beautiful soprano. And I just sat there and listened to her. And then when she stopped, I sang something else. And we traded off like this for about 15 minutes, just singing. Mm-hmm. And then she sang something in French, I think it was. And so then I asked her to continue singing. I was recording this. I have a recording of it, which is neat. And then I started singing Dona Nobis Pacem, and she sang a duet over it. She didn't really know it, and that was interesting, but she got the gist of it quickly, and she started singing floating soprano over my voice, and it was just stunning. And then we both stopped, and I just turned, I just turned over my shoulder and said, gracias, merci. And she walked out. And I walked out of the church later after her, and all I saw was her backpack walking up the street. You know, I just saw her walking up the street. And I asked my husband, did you see that person? He said, oh yeah, she came out of the church, she was just beaming. You know? So that's kind of a Camino Angel experience where, you know, you just never know. You never know whether you're there for somebody or somebody's there for you or what's gonna happen. Beautiful things happen. But back to the story of Irene, because later on, 2 weeks later, we lost contact with Irene, and then 2 weeks later, we met up again, and we were walking side by side for about 6 hours, which happens. And during those 6 hours, I finally worked up the nerve to ask her if she was carrying some sort of grief, because I sensed it. And she opened up to me that she had lost her 23-year-old son. He'd died a couple years ago. And that was why she was doing the Camino. And what was really poignant about it was that she said, you know, I have to tell you something. When you were singing Dona Nobis Pacem in that church, she said, I didn't think I could stand it because they sang that song at my son's funeral. They sang that hymn at my son's funeral, and I've never been able to hear it since. But in that church that day with you, I was able to sing it. You know, falteringly, but she was able to sing it. And so I was like, wow, you know, what are the chances I would have picked this very hymn that hurt me? So, you know, there's things like that happen all the time on pilgrimages. And the thing is to notice them. People's backstory and their story. What was really interesting was for me to discover my own backstory, and I had to sort of tease that out of myself. We got to a very significant place called Monte Irago. And Monte Irago is the highest point on the Camino, and there's a giant cross there of made of iron. And it was it's set there as a place for pilgrims to. They carry stones from home, usually, or a memento from home, and they leave it there as a symbol of something that they would like to unburden themselves, they want to leave behind, they are done with, and they are asking for St. James's help to let this go. Well, I came with my little stone that I brought from home, and I dutifully tied it onto I found there was all sorts of ribbons and all sorts of craziness tied on this, you know, on this Monte Irago cross. I tied it up there, but it's... And I made my little ablutions, but then I sort of felt that this was like sort of like cutting a ribbon. It was a formality. It didn't feel like I was really being true to why. I have my little reason. Here's the stone. Yes, that's why I came. Just this little pebble on this pile of stones that is as high as the ceiling of this room, that people have been leaving there for thousands of years. And all these stones have significance. It's just an amazing thing. So what was interesting was that I was getting my pack, and I was getting ready to go, and I said, wait a minute, I'm not done here. But there were people gabbing on the mount, and I considered it a holy space, but they were kind of talking loudly. And so I edged over to the mound one more time. Kids playing soccer over here, soccer ball hit me in the head, and I said, okay, this is not exactly a solemn, you know, it doesn't feel very solemn at all, but I've got to do this. This is important. And so I went up, and there was a retaining wall against the stones where I just began to come into, you know, I thought, well, maybe these people will quiet down if I make this universal symbol of reverence. Now, didn't. They kept talking. They kept talking, and I was like, oh, my gosh, I can't do this. And then I just got quiet again, and then a thought came to me. I said, it spontaneously started doing this. And that worked. They went away. And it was amazing. And so then I realized that I had a deeper prayer, a much deeper prayer to leave there. And it was symbolized by the cord that was on my pilgrim staff. I had a very tall pilgrim staff. And it had a paracord on it. And I realized that was why I had carried the paracord all that time. And it was for that backstory I had. And it just emerged at that place. And places are so powerful this way. They can bring out, through intention and attention, they can bring out, they can tease out the deepest parts of ourselves. And I realized I needed, this paracord represented my being bound by certain things, and I needed to release those things. And so that was incredibly powerful. The Camino itself also brings up relationships. You have relationships to nature, you have relationships to people. It is completely relational. You have solidarity with the centuries of pilgrims that have come before you, the ones that will come after you. You're emptying yourself into the landscape. As I walked, I just emptied myself. After a while, I ran out of thoughts. I just ran out of things to think about. There was just nothing I could think about anymore. And then I sort of just, as with a kenotic experience of just emptying into the landscape, my dreams became archetypal. They became dreams of like Grimm's fairy tales. Like I can't even explain it. They were like Joseph Campbell, like summaries. I can't even explain that, but I felt like I was just peeling away the layers and getting down to the essence of myself, my relationship to my husband, came up in microcosm. They were microcosmic incidences of conflicts that we've always had in our marriage. They came up in manageable bite-sized pieces, and we actually worked out things that had been issues for years between us. We also spent a lot of alone time. We did not spend a lot of time talking with each other. We spent a lot of time in our own space. It's very important to be very mindful of needing a lot of solitude on a pilgrimage. Anyway, I don't want to run over. The things that I brought back were, most importantly, that I was able to share this experience with people like I am right now, and try to inspire them to go do it, because it is so doable. The infrastructure's there, the details. The commitment is what you have to make. The rest is just travel details. You know, it really is minor stuff. It's not a big deal. I will finish with reading this poem, which I had help on translating this from Herman. And I found this written on the wall outside of Najera. It was written in a beautiful calligraphic, black calligraphic style with a paintbrush. Someone took great care to write this. It was in Spanish, and I translated it with the help of Herman and other pilgrims. Pilgrim, who calls you? What mysterious force draws you here? It is neither, Let me start at the beginning. Dust, mud, sun, and rain is the Camino de Santiago. Thousands of pilgrims and more than 1,000 years. Pilgrim, who calls you? What mysterious force draws you here? Neither the field of stars, the Compostela, nor the great cathedrals. It is not the bravery of Navarra, nor the Rioja wine, not the Galician seafood, nor the Castilian Pat Plateau. Pilgrim, who calls you? What mysterious force draws you here? It is neither the folk of the way, nor the ways of the country folk. It is not the history or the culture, nor the cocky calzado rooster, not the Gaudi palace, nor the Ponferrada castle. All these things I see in passing, and they are all a great joy. But the voice that calls me fills me with an even greater feeling. The force that compels me, the force that draws me here, I cannot explain. Only the Most High knows.
It's sort of unfair to just give you 30 minutes. Yeah, it's been 4 months. You can tell there's so much to unpack. It'll take forever to unpack that.
Yeah. We're debriefing daily.
Could we just ask you a question?
Sure. Please do.
Yeah. How heavy was your backpack?
It was 17 pounds. Eight kilograms.
That's excellent.
And everybody is a fanatic. There are wonderful forums. If you ever want support for going on the Camino, there are forums of veteran pilgrims who will give you every possible piece of advice you would ever want to hear, and further, about backpacks, weights, hiking boots, all that, all the gear stuff. And people who go ultralight, like I ran into a Swedish woman the very first day who said, "I am only carrying a space blanket with safety pins." And I said, "Well, I hope that works for you." I never saw her again. She disappeared. But.
Well, 17 pounds sounds ultralight. That's pretty light.
But that's not ultralight. But the ultralight philosophy of carrying stuff, which is everything in your backpack should serve more than one function. Yeah. You know, you carry a sarong and it's got many functions, that sort of thing.
So what did you do about laundry and
Most albergues have facilities for you to wash your clothes. It's called a sink. And you carry your soap with you, and you curse that soap too. You curse the weight of carrying bar soap. You curse everything in your bag. So you're walking. Basically, every day is you get up, you have your cafe con leche, you get on the road, you walk for an hour or so until you feel hungry. You stop, you eat. Then you walk more, and then you try to get a bed in an albergue, and you throw your backpack on next to it, and then you go wash your clothes, go and eat, fall into a stupor-like sleep, and then get up, and it's like a repeat, same thing, every single day. And there's something really beautiful about that simple pattern.
How many miles a day did you walk?
We walked about between, at the beginning, on 15 kilometers a day, and at the end, 30 kilometers when we got into shape. But between, in other words, between 10 and 20 miles a day. It really varied, depending on the terrain and our energy levels. So, but we walked a total of 400 and something kilometers, about 300 something miles. And it was about the distance from Washington to Boston. That's how I had to sort of envision it, that we walked in a month, in 35 days. It took us 35 days to skipping a big 200 kilometer portion of it in the middle by bus. And you can do that. You can do segments of it. And the Spanish people and the Europeans, they just go when they have a weekend or a week, and they go and just do little segments of it. That's why you have your passport. Because eventually, you link together all those places, and you take your passport and present it to them, if the Compostela is important to you. Which, the Compostela is the little certificate you get at the end that says, you have traveled the way, the ancient way of the Jacobian way. It's the way of Jacob. And it's an ancient path, and so you get this thing all in Latin with your Latin name and everything, your name in Latin, and I'm Alexion in Latin, I didn't know. And they write it out, and they give it to you, and then you go home and frame it, and it's like, well, there it is. And then if you care to, you can walk on to the really Celtic old Druid route, which is to go to Finisterre, the end of the earth, which is about another 100 kilometers past Santiago. Where you go, and that's where the end of the earth was. If you kept walking west, the end of the known world, where you'd fall off the edge, you go there, you'd stop, and you'd burn your clothes. And Druids and Celts used to go there to die. They went there to die. It was the end of the earth, where the sun sets over the ocean. So a lot of people, that old goal of going to Finisterre has been renewed. There's a great interest in going there, because most people don't feel complete until they go across the entire country of Spain. We started in France at the foot of the Pyrenees in Saint-Jean, Pied-de-Port, the traditional pilgrimage stop to start. Straight up, first day, 1,400 meters, step straight up. And it's an incredible challenge, but it's a trial by fire. If you can make it to the top of the Pyrenees, it's an incredible sense of accomplishment that first day. If you've never done anything like that, which I never have done anything like that, getting to the top of the Pyrenees, I took a photo of my husband. He was a different person. The very first day, getting to the top of that mountain, you could see it in his face. He changed. It's astonishing. And I love this one pilgrim summed it up by saying, in the course of your lifetime, it's a wonderful thing. It's a worthwhile thing to just do something grand. And that's what the pilgrimage is. That's what doing a pilgrimage is. It's a grand thing to do. Grand. And I think it's great to honor oneself and one's life to take time out and do something grand.
40 days.
Yeah. Or a short walk through.
Mine was 40 miles, so at least.
That is a mystical number.
So I'm not going to say much, okay? We don't have a lot of time. I'll just say a little bit and whet your appetite for the Jesus Trail. So if you don't have time for St. James, go to Jesus. The Jesus Trail is only 40 miles. It's the easy way, really. Come on down. I see that hand out there.
Raise it.
Yeah, amen, brother. So this is the map. I'll pass it around. It's broke. It's split up because I had it in my back pocket. And it finally sweated through it and broke it all to pieces.
But plastic bag.
Yeah. So just very briefly here. So Garrett and I left from Waco. We drove to DFW Airport. We met Lily, who was a friend of his, a Truett Seminary student. Said a short prayer together before we departed. she was on one airplane, we were on another. We ended up being delayed. She wasn't delayed. So we got to Tel Aviv down here 4 hours late. We had decided, okay, if one of us is late, the other is going to go on. And we were trying to get to Nazareth right here that day. Well, we arrived sundown Friday.
Bad timing. So, didn't think that through.
Not a good time.
Didn't think that through.
I tried to remember. Yeah. Go to the root of everything that happens. I was just kind of mad. The airport shut down, basically. There's nobody in the airport. International airport. So we ended up finding a place to stay in Tel Aviv. And we couldn't get to Nazareth the next day because there's no buses running. So we hitched a ride with some Russian pilgrims and got there. We got to Nazareth, met up Billy. The trail starts in Nazareth. It goes through Cana here, and it goes to Capernaum right there, Sea of Galilee, and that's 40 miles, so basically 10 miles a day is what we were doing. The purpose of our pilgrimage was a pilgrimage of healing for a pilgrimage for healing and recovery. And so we invited, Garrett, Lily, and I invited folks to give us prayers that they wanted us to pray for them or for their loved ones or friends. And so we each had a stack of prayers. And we had sort of pre-selected sites along the way that we were going to deliver the prayers. And by deliver, I mean voice. And then also actually leave the prayer. And so there were experiences along the way, and I'm not going to talk about those now. But some of you gave me prayers, okay, to take, and I was able to deliver those. I didn't weigh my pack, but I've got a picture of it. It's this big, okay. And then we had water, of course, but the pack's pretty small. From Waco to Waco, yep. That's it. Okay.
My prayers were pretty heavy.
Okay. So you had 5 pounds worth of
it's
prayers.
5 pounds
of prayers.
Okay.
All right. Anyway, to Cana, where we spent a night, we didn't have reservations either, and that worked out, though I almost didn't. This night here was at a kibbutz. Stayed with the kibbutz there as a hotel that the kibbutz has. Then we got to Arabel over here, which is really begins to be beautiful. The old Roman road is here. And so we were walking the way that Jesus would have walked to Capernaum. So it's called the Jesus Trail, and it goes through towns, villages, orchards, garbage dumps. It's on dirt roads, it's on highways, it's on trails through various places. Sepphoris is right here, the ancient city of Sepphoris, where Jesus perhaps was a builder. Mary is thought to be from Sepphoris traditionally. So the way itself is... I became aware that, okay, that as I got out of the town, to hear these birds, to hear the wind, to see this landscape was basically what Jesus saw and what he experienced in that. We stayed at a bed and breakfast here. Then this is a high point. And it's a cliffy area, cliffs of Arabel, beautiful area. You can see the entire Sea of Galilee here. And you know, this is it was an experience to ponder that that's where the Jesus wisdom emerged, that it exploded right there, and just to see that's where it started, that's where it happened, and that is something that that we saw in Philip today, and this idea that the soil of the universe was ready for it, that was sort of the way I was experiencing that. The soil of the universe was ready for that. And just one note, we were trying to get to Capernaum, but because of blisters and sun, we didn't quite get to Capernaum. We didn't get to see a valley. And we went into a church there. We had planned to go into the church of the loaves and fishes, the traditional side of Jesus multiplying the loaves and fishes. And I delivered the prayers there. And one of the folks that had asked me to pray was Barbara Wells, a spiritual director in Waco, Episcopalian, who attends my Sunday school class. She goes to church at St. Paul's, but comes to my Sunday school class and has been a member of that class for a number of years. And I delivered the prayer for her there. And as I prayed, I became aware that I needed to pray for her death. And it wasn't any kind of a morbid thing. It was just that I felt a need to do that, to help, to pray that God would help her in the transition from life to death. And when I got back to the hostel after delivering those prayers, I got an email that she was in hospice. She had not been sick when I left, and she so she was in hospice, and we returned home to Waco on a Sunday. I went to the hospital and I put my hand on her and I said, we love you. She hadn't been responsive for days, and she died an hour later. Mm-hmm. It was really a humbling thing to be a part of her transition and for that impression to occur there. So anyway, thank you, so those of you that were a part of that, because I did think about you, pray for you, pray for the order, and so that was a part of my own need to pray for this order. I want to close with one of the prayers that Lynn gave me, and that will be our close today. I was with her yesterday and she said to me, "Honey, I can't remember my past. I can't think of the future. I don't know who I am now, nor what to do with this emptiness." It was poignant, so my prayer for her would be, fill that inner emptiness with your fullness and the presence that knows and loves her. Amen.
We'll meet in 10 minutes in the chapter.
That's a great storyteller. Oh boy, I'm telling you.
The knee. eat them.
I know. Jesus didn't take the bus. What would Jesus do?
He would take the bus. Find a donkey.
Back 48 hours from, you know, from Santiago to get home. And I was a quivering basket case.
Interesting.
But at the same time,
this would be interesting.
Even if it had been the best of circumstances, re-entry into her heart. I remember my first plumbers to Ireland when I got dropped off in Dublin after being in the Little Islands at Glendalough for like 10 days. I was dropped off in Dublin. Everyone went there some place to go and shop. And I sat there. I just wept. I didn't know what to do. I was completely bereft. And then I realized that's what I don't care how short the pilgrimage is. It's something to contend with. That whole thing about the return, that's worth a study itself.
Now we do
Billy.